is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello everybody, this is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne County, and I'm at the Calaveras office in downtown San Andreas. I'm so fortunate to be able to talk to Scott Onetto. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
And Scott, what do we call you these days? What is your job description?
Yeah, so I am officially back from a year-long sabbatical and coming back as a farm advisor. So I'll be working with local ranchers and farmers, helping them with any problems or assistance they may need.
Great. Yeah. That is wonderful. And you just assisted us in the garden, the demonstration garden.
Yeah, we're going to be...
The Calaveras Master Gardeners.
Yeah, that might be another great show topic.
Yes. They're going to plan on a new demonstration. We'll keep you to stay tuned.
Yeah, we're looking at doing basically a small little demonstration at the Government Center in the Master Gardener Demonstration Garden, looking at various control treatments for weed control. So be looking at both some over-the-counter herbicides that people may be very familiar with, as well as a number of organic herbicides that are fairly safe to use, and also some mechanical control treatments.
I know, it sounds very exciting. I'm just, sabbatical is not a vacation.
It was not. It was
just to keep that clear.
Yeah, definitely. I think I worked harder this last year than I have in a long time.
Oh my gosh.
It was a lot of really long days just sitting without any interruptions and just a lot of writing. So it was a very rewarding experience, but also very productive.
Well, good. And one of the things that you produced is a field guide. It says weeds, forages, and natives of the central Sierra Nevada.
Yeah.
And this just came out.
Yeah,
this
so
is
it's
hot,
a
off,
hot
the press.
Off the press, a brand new publication, something that's been on my to-do list for, God, I hate to say it's been over 10 years now. We've produced a number of different field guides for landowners, for farmers and ranchers to help identify some of the more problematic weeds that they have. And we've had various different publications and posters or little field guides over the years. And we've been out of them for a number of years. And so one of my to-dos has been to recreate a field guide and update it. And so I spent a good majority of my sabbatical revamping some of our older publications. And so this turned out to be a fairly lengthy field guide. Our older one was maybe 20 pages long, and I think this one might be 170 pages.
It's
a little over 170 pages, and covers roughly 80 different plants.
Oh my gosh.
And I say plants because I originally was just looking at highlighting weeds, and then once I got into finishing all the weeds, then I really started talking more with some of the agricultural groups locally, and they were like, well, what about some of the desirable plants, like some of the forages that our livestock want?
Sure.
You know, how do we tell the bad ones and from the good ones? Mm-hmm. And so that got me rethinking that I really should include some of those desirable forages and maybe the lookalike native. So we have a lot of native plants that also made it into the book, so mm-hmm. so people can see what native plants they have on their property as well.
Okay, so I'm looking at the shape of this book. It's really a nice shape. It really is.
Yeah.
And it does say right at the top, field guide. So when you actually produce this book, what is the intent? How is it going to be used?
Yeah, so my intent, I wanted something that somebody would be inclined to use, So not just a book that they would have on a shelf in their home, but something that they would actually take out into the field. And so I purposely made it the size that it is so it will fit in a back pocket. And also a great place to store it is in your glove box or in a little center console in a vehicle. Just, you know, have it with you because often when you're out and you see something that you're not sure what it is, it's great to have, you know, access to a book to be able to thumb through and and try to find what that plant might be.
I'm not only to satisfy my curiosity as far as what a plant is, but why is it important to identify these plants?
Yeah, so, you know, I think a big portion of this is, you know, I call it a weed field guide. And, you know, basically a weed is, you know, a plant growing out of place. And that's kind of a very loose definition because, you know, anything, technically anything could be a weed to somebody, right?
Sure.
But there's certainly weeds in there that, you know, can be much more problematic, and that not only for an individual person, but for industries. And mostly I'm thinking agricultural industries, so our livestock producers, or even, you know, poisonous plants around your home or landscape that might actually cause harm to, you know, maybe a child that doesn't know any better, or maybe a pet that you may have that's curious and wants to chew on things, you know, those little puppy phases that you have if you have a puppy. So really just being able to know what's in and around your environment, whether you live in an apartment or a condo, or maybe you have a home in a subdivision, or maybe you have 5 acres, whatever the situation you may be in, it's important to know what's growing around you. And so you don't have to know every single plant, but when you typically see a plant that you've never seen before, those are the ones that typically should kind of raise that red flag of of curiosity to say, that looks different. I haven't seen that before. Maybe I should find out what that is.
Okay. Well, that now, once you have this guide, the field guide, and it is in your car and and your or your back pocket and you're traveling around with it, what is the best way to use it? Because I know you mentioned it's got
so
about 170
so I organized it into a couple of basically different sections because I think for usefulness, you know, you want to be able to kind of identify a plant as quickly as possible. And so I basically split it into three sections. One, the first section is a section on what I call thistles and thistle-like plants, right? So things that look like a thistle. So people, for the most part, know what thistles are. It's those spiny plants, you know, things that are often in the sunflower family. You know, things like, you know, yellow star thistle and milk thistle, all these things that we, you know, commonly associate with thistles.
Plants.
Yeah, typically these are the ones
you don't want to touch.
Yeah, these are typically the ones that are pretty pokey and ones that you just don't want. And so we've got a section, if a plant looks like a thistle, there's a section that just has thistles. So you can turn to that section. There's also a section on grasses. And again, that's a fairly broad and loose term. So anything that kind of looks like a grass, there's a section that you can turn to in the book and then just thumb through those pages to see if the plant is in there. There's also a section on trees and shrubs.
Okay.
So if it's a plant that's, you know, large, like a shrub or a full-size tree, or basically woody is kind of the definition that I would use to distinguish a tree or a shrub, you can turn to that section. And then there's a section on vines, which would be things like poison oak or English ivy, things that kind of vine, have a viney growth structure. And then there's the last section is things that are the non-thistle broadleaf plants. So basically anything that has a broadleaf that isn't a thistle, those are kind of grouped in their own little category.
Okay. Gosh, that's great. Now, there's something else that I noticed. You rate the weeds.
Yeah, so I tried to distinguish, you know, the good ones from the bad ones.
There
are some of the desirables in there. So I, you know, made sure if I included some plants that are good to have around, whether it be for, you know, livestock feed or for maybe it's a great pollinator, any of those kinds of characteristics or attributes, I try to make note of that. But then for the weedy ones, I tried to also give some some ranking as to, you know, some of the worst of the worst I tried to really call out. And so I put a little what I call take action button.
It's
very impressive. Yeah, it kind of reminds you of the Staples.
Right, exactly. It does.
Whatever that little button said.
I almost want to press it.
Yes. So those weeds that, you know, are some of the worst of the worst, typically they're in fairly smaller populations because many of the counties and state jurisdictions are trying to keep those weeds under control. So I tried to make sure I identify those. So if people see those particular weeds, those are ones that you just don't want to not pay attention
right.
to, that you really want
right.
to take action
okay.
and do some sort of a control treatment.
Okay. Now you actually talk about how to control it.
Yeah, that was
right
a
there.
New addition that I added to this field guide that all of our previous ones really didn't have. Our previous ones mostly just had a few pictures mm-hmm. and a little bit of description about the weed, and I really wanted to make sure that I covered some control strategies. So if somebody
okay.
does see a weed and they want to take action, I wanted to give them some different techniques for control, and I tried to cover both chemical and non-chemical. So
okay.
if there's some treatments that don't use chemicals that are effective, I tried to make that very clear, whether it was, you know, hand pulling or, you know, maybe it could be, using weed eaters or a shovel or maybe using livestock as a tool if you have animals. I tried to make those in there if it was an effective treatment.
So you covered the whole range in a very small space.
I had to use a very
really?
Small font. Yeah. So, yeah,
there's a lot of information.
You may need to put some readers on because, the text is small. I tried to get as much as I possibly could in that book.
But with the pictures, you've got beautiful pictures,
yeah.
and you've got pictures of the plant when it's young.
Yeah, I tried to include some different stages of growth for each plant. So, like you said, either the seedling or very small early growth stages, as well as later on as they start to flower.
Okay.
So different stages throughout the year. Hopefully that'll help with identification.
Right, and then even you've got a picture on the Canada thistle as far as what it looks like in the landscape.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. Looking at the bull thistle, there's a variety of pictures in the seedling stage when it's starting to flower. The pictures are really nice.
Yeah, I
have to admit.
Very
beautiful.
Fortunate. I have a colleague that retired a few years ago who was a weed scientist at UC Davis, but also an amazing photographer. So a lot of the photos are from Dr. Joe DiTommaso, and then the others I got permission from a number of other folks that contribute to some online weed galleries. So I think there's I took a number of photos, but I
okay.
relied on others that had some just really good
because,
photography
I mean,
skills.
I rely on photos a lot, so if I'm out in the field and my phone doesn't work,
yeah.
I want to look at a
exactly.
picture. So this is great. There's another really beautiful thing about this field guide. I understand it's free.
It is free, yeah. So that was one of the things I wanted to try to do was create a guide that was available to the public and made it free. And so through many gracious donations, and I will read them off because I think they warrant being acknowledged, a number of local organizations helped give funds to make this publication available. And so including ourselves, the University of California Cooperative Extension, we also got funds from the Amador County Department of Agriculture, the Amador County Farm Bureau, the Amador County Resource Conservation District, the Calaveras County Department of Agriculture, the Calaveras County Resource Conservation District, the Tuolumne County Cattlemen's Association, El Dorado County Department of Agriculture, the Motherlode Land Trust, Tuolumne County Department of Agriculture, Tuolumne County Farm Bureau, Tuolumne County Resource Conservation District, and then the two huge sponsors that really contributed a lot towards the funding of this book was the Northern California Power Agency and the East Bay Municipal Utility District.
Oh, that's wonderful. So anybody can come into the Cooperative Extension office and pick up one of these books for free.
Yeah, so come by one of our offices across, whether you're in Jackson, Placerville, San Andreas, or Sonora, any of our Cooperative Extension offices will have them. As well as the county agricultural departments.
Okay.
I'm also, some of the local pest control businesses have also taken some stock of these as well and are handing them out.
Great.
And I would actually like to get them into some of the local feed stores as well.
Oh,
so
perfect.
We'll try to get those out here in the next few weeks.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they're free. Come in and get one for yourself, grab one for your neighbor. Really the purpose is to get this information out. So
perfect. But it's also online.
It is, yeah.
That's where I saw it first.
Yeah, this was the first time I've ever done, I guess you could call, an ebook. And so we did put it online. And so if you have a mobile device, whether it be an iPhone or an iPad or any other mobile device, you can go to our website, our Central Sierra website, and it's available right on the home screen. You really can't miss it.
Right.
So it's currently not downloadable as a book. You have to have internet access to use it, but we are working on a downloadable version as well.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
So yeah, go to our website, cecentralsierra.ucanr.edu, or just Google search
Central Sierra Cooperative Extension. It's right there. And it's a great field guide. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about it. We ran out of time. We'll have to have you come back.
Great.
Thank you,
thank
Scott.
You. Thank
Bye.
You so much.
This is KAADLP 103.5 FM, Sonora, California.
This is Debbie Powell, Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne Counties. We're so fortunate. We've got our Tuolumne Master Gardener, Marion Chambers, who happens to know just about everything about pests, insects, diseases, and then also life's problems. She's got the answers to life's problems. And I've learned so much from Marion. But today, we're hoping to learn about some of these diseases that can affect the veggies and the fruit that we're growing to eat. So hello, Marion. We're gonna get right into some of these diseases, because wouldn't it be nice if everything we grew never got a disease? That would be like fantasy land.
Well, if we had fantasy land like that, then we wouldn't have a nursery industry.
That's true. But one of the things you're mentioning, because you also are in charge of the hotline and the help desk, is some of the questions that start coming in have to do with the disease that affects tomatoes.
This time of year, depending on where you are, you're going to start getting green tomatoes and they're going to start ripening up, and you're going to get a disease. It's called blossom end rot, or the bottom of the tomato kind of turns brown and kind of gets a little bit mushy. And what that really is it's a calcium deficiency on your tomatoes. That's very easily prevented. You can buy calcium supplements, and when you plant, you can actually plant at that time. The best way to really do it is you save your eggshells all winter. You throw them in a blender or you put them in a baggie, whatever you do, you pulverize them down to almost a powder, and you mix that in with the soil, a lot of it, when you plant your tomatoes. And you use a fertilizer that actually has a lot of calcium in it too. And that's what will prevent that calcium, that blossom end rot.
And that's it? That's all you need to do is, if you can remember to save your eggshells?
That's pretty much it. So, you can get off of the UCIPM website all the information on blossom end rot, and that's all it really is a calcium deficiency. It'll show up a little bit in peppers, but it's usually very prominent in tomatoes.
Do some people get confused? Do they think that sometimes it's because the tomatoes were sitting on the ground ripening?
The other thing is inconsistent watering will also do that as well. But the predominant cause is actually a calcium deficiency.
Okay. You know. Wow. Well, that sounds pretty easy. I think I can save my eggshells.
you can actually buy a calcium spray to spray on the plants as well if you forget the eggshells. But you can also add the eggshells later by working them in with the soil. So every time you water, the calcium will leach down to the roots and strengthen the plant that way.
Is it possible to give a tomato plant too much calcium? Could you add too many eggshells?
No, because they'll leach out whatever that's not going to work.
Okay.
And your earthworms will really like them as well.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's a good tip. Now, for anybody that's growing peaches, I love peaches, but there's a disease that just can't seem to leave peach trees alone. And what is that?
That is called peach leaf curl. And peach leaf curl is something, it's a fungus, it's called Tephrina deformans. And because what it does is the fungus gets in and the fungus is activated by moisture. So when we get those late spring rains, what happens is it activates the fungus in the plant. And so the leaves start to kind of bubble and get deformed, start turning red. And that means that the fungus is active in that plant. So the best thing to do is in the winter, you have to start in like January. You start spraying dormant oil on all of your stone fruits. And when you start doing that, you start to suppress the fungus activity during the growing season. But you always get that one late rain in the foothills, and that's all it takes. So UC IBM website has a great test note and a quick tip that discusses only peach leaf curl. And sanitation is the number one thing. The minute you start seeing those leaves, you pick them off the tree, you pick them off the ground, you do not compost them. You actually bag them up and throw them away. Because what happens is the fungus will start its cycle. Once it hits the ground, it'll be taken up by the plant again, and you still have that cycle.
So can this type of thing, play the devil's advocate. So what if you don't want to do that housekeeping chore? I mean, I don't like to do a housekeeping anyway. So to go out and pick leaves off the tree and make sure they're off the ground. So, you know, what happens with me being lazy? What if I don't do that?
You're going to get some really, either no fruit or some really bad fruit. Because if the fungus is really bad, you're going to start seeing bubbling coming up out of your fruit. That means the fungus has actually gotten into the fruit itself.
Oh.
So at that point, the tree starts to become extremely stressed. And probably you'll be reducing its lifespan at that point. And the tree just won't be healthy because it can't function the way it's supposed to because of the fungus.
Wow, you made me feel guilty.
Well,
I think I'm going to do housekeeping and get all. Now, if I do that, would I get any fruit if I take off all those diseased leaves?
You will, because the tree will start to flush out again and will start flushing out healthy leaves once the weather warms up. So that's what's kind of made it really hard, especially the spring of 2019. We had 2 weeks solid of rain in May, which is extremely unusual. And so this year in 2020, we've had this fluctuation in rain and temperature and humidity. So now we're pulling out of that and we're going into a dry period. So the fungus will start to subside, but you still need to pick off those diseased leaves to break the cycle for next year.
Okay. Now, there's also another disease that can affect fruit trees, and And is that fire blight?
It is fire blight. Fire blight is a bacteria that is, ironically enough, transmitted by bees. Bees will take the bacteria when they're foraging on the blossoms, and they'll move it from plant to plant.
Oh.
So fire blight, being a bacteria, once again, it needs a wet spring. And the reason they call it fire blight is as the bacteria moves down the stem starts to turn black and get a shepherd's hook look, and it starts getting sticky and oozy, and that's the bacteria that's coming out. And it will slowly move down towards the main trunk of the tree. And the biggest intermediate host is pyracantha. It loves pyracantha.
When you say a host, meaning that's where the bacteria likes to be?
Yes, that's their preferred place to be. So fire blight is apples, pears. It can get on toyon, but the best place that it overwinters is on pyracantha, because now, most people ignore pyracantha.
Right. Now, can you tell if it's on the pyracantha? Is it also doing the fire blight on the pyracantha?
It'll be the same thing. It'll be the kind of the stem turning black, the tip of the stem kind of starting to look like a shepherd's hook, getting kind of that oozy thing. And the best way to do it, once again, you see IPM has a great quick tip and a pest note on how to take care of it. But it's every cut that you take, you have to disinfect your pruners. Because if you start to cut into a bacteria and you get it on your pruning equipment, you're just moving that bacteria to everything else. So
okay.
That's the sanitation.
Right. Now, so maybe having a pail with kind of a Clorox or bleach water.
Yeah, they have that in the pest note.
Okay.
It can be a very, like a 5-10% solution, bleach solution to do that. Or you can just spray your pruners with a disinfectant that takes care of a bacteria. So that could be whatever's on the market. If you can find Lysol, I think you're lucky.
If you can find it.
So yeah. Apples and pears are both very notorious for getting fire blight.
Okay. Is there any way to protect those trees from fire blight?
Well, they do have a couple things on the market that I haven't read a whole lot about. It's used in commercial agriculture. It's a product called streptomycin, and that's all it gets is a bacteria. And the only place I believe that has it is in Tuolumne County is at the hydroponic store in Sonora.
Oh.
The garden company up at C&W Supply off of Via Este, she may have it.
Okay.
But it's fairly new to the home user market.
Now, when your tree gets that fire blight, is it generally only one branch, or can it affect the whole tree
It's usually one or two branches.
Okay.
That's what it is.
And does it mean that the tree's a goner if it has that branch?
It's going to affect the vigor and of the tree and of that whole affected area.
So you're going to want to cut that out and prune it out.
You're going to cut it out and prune it out. And I just remember there's another host, which is a hawthorn. You don't see that many hawthorn trees anymore.
Oh yeah.
Hawthorns are a wonderful tree. They're also in the malus family. They will also get fire blight.
Okay. Well, you're not going to believe it, Marion. We ran out of time again. We're going to have you come back.
Well, okay.
And I sure appreciate it. So I want to thank you so much, and we'll be talking again very soon.
Thank you, Debbie.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us. If you would like to contact us for more information, remember you can contact our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912, or you can look us up on the kaad-lp.org website, look for Over the Garden Gate. Thank you.